mushroom alone in the dark. What is the effect of being with people who are either observers or participants in the...
Oh, well, for me, I mean, you have to understand, I mean, I'm a double Scorpio and a kind of reclusive type anyway. The reason I don't particularly like tripping with people is because I just worry. I'm a worrier. And if I'm stoned and somebody else is stoned, then I worry. And I listen to their breathing and I wonder... And I wonder how they're doing, and I wonder if I should ask how they're doing. And I just lose all spontaneity, and I become completely the victim of my imagined concern for this other person. Well, then, and then the other thing that happens is people are the weirdest objects in the universe. And if you're stoned and you come upon another person stoned, I mean, they can just unleash something you could never have imagined or conceived of. I remember, I think I learned this lesson the hard way in India, but years ago, once at Sarnath, and it happened many times, but this was typical. Sarnath is the place where the Buddha taught his first sermon after attaining enlightenment. He walked from Bodh Gaya to Sarnath. So I took mescaline there with these two women who were friends of mine, and it's all nicely green and sculpted, and we were sitting there under a tree, and I swear, you know, 500 yards away there were these two Indian guys walking across my field of vision, and I was sitting there and I was loaded and I was watching the traceries, and then I looked out across my field of vision and I saw these two Indian guys stop dead in the center of my field of vision, and then they said something to each other, and then they turned 90 degrees so they were now facing me, and they began walking toward me, and I was horrified. And I looked down, I said, I was so horrified that I said, I can't believe this is happening. I refuse to believe this is happening. I will just look at the ground in front of me like this. So I started looking at the ground in front of me, and I looked and looked and looked and looked until two pairs of brown feet appeared in my field of vision. And then I looked up at these guys, and they had caught the vibe. And they wanted to know what was going on. And several experiences like this caused me to believe that, you know, you should really bury it deep before you take it into public. The other thing I've noticed is, you know, if you're stoned in a confined space, there's a certain amount of control of synchronicity. I mean, there's rustling in the corners and batting at the windows and so forth, but this you can handle. But if you take it out into public, God, it's just absolutely uncontrollable. I mean, you could be struck by a meteorite. You could be abducted by extraterrestrials. A safe could fall on you. Anything could happen because the statistical disruption of ordinary probability is so great. What did I say? Oh, I remember what I said. I looked up and I said, cannot be interrogated. It was good, but it didn't work. See, how long have you been in this place? You're coming from which place? No, what I found in India was people were telepathic, but it didn't make them like you any better. It just gave them a fantastic kind of in. But I think group psychedelic taking is very promising, and people who can do it, groups that can do it and stick with it over years, log amazing experiences. But it's very hard, because what immediately emerges if you have a group of people doing this stuff is it will veer off in some weird direction. One person will get a quote-unquote funny idea. And then the funny idea everybody polarizes for and against the funny idea. And then they have to decide, well, you know, they're losing, so-and-so's losing their mind. They're in too deep with this. Say, no, no, this is the answer, and we're moving. And just, you know, and quickly cognitive dissonance builds up, and it's very, very hard. I have a correspondent in the Midwest, a group of psychiatrists who over 6 years took mushrooms once a month together, and they went through amazing contortions of wife trading and not speaking and speaking and denouncing and embracing, and just because they were, you know, because it just unleashes this stuff and then it crawls around. So I prefer to do it by myself and then, you know, get all combed and pinned back together before I present myself to the troops in the morning, because, you know, in the height of the thing, you could proclaim anything.
Now, it's only possible for a group of people who have been fairly experienced with psychedelics to get together wanting to do this very wonderful group
work,
telepathic thing, and to create what they think, at least to try to anticipate what might be things that would pull it apart, that would unplug one.
It's hard to anticipate. I mean, I've really found that the way the mushroom works is it reads you perfectly, much better than you can read yourself. And then it comes at you with the one thing that you are vulnerable to. And because it knows you like an open book and can lead you practically any direction that it wants. But I think group work is interesting and should be pursued, and couple work is very interesting and should be pursued. I'm very conservative. I mean, my approach to it is I basically turn it on and then I back off and watch. That's all I ever do. And I've seen, I don't have the magical mentality. I don't want to get something or take control of someone or a situation for good or ill. But people who do make great progress in all of these areas, you know. I mean, people who want to design electronic circuits or play Bach on the piano. But I don't do anything. I'm interested kind of in the essence of the thing, what it is, the Ding an Sich, the thing in itself. And that's why I don't listen to music. This horrifies some people. So you don't listen to music? No, I mean, I have listened to music. I know what it does to music. It makes it the best thing in the world. But without music, it also can do that. And so I sit in silent darkness, and I maintain that's where, you know, the essence of the thing is. Then it's not colored by sound or light or expectation. I'm trying to see beyond the mask, see what this thing is in itself, for itself. Anybody else? Anything else? You mean in terms of in the proximity to the trip? A lot of people like to fast. I don't particularly say you should fast. I just say you should have an empty stomach. 5 hours without eating is good. You should just be cleaned out, you know, bring a certain amount of attention and respect to it. And it's very, very kind to beginners. The complexity comes later in the unfolding of the kinks of the personality, but I think it's very gentle to beginners. You mean actually what does it consist of? It's no sugar, no alcohol, no salt, sexual abstinence. It's basically a diet of manioc and certain fish. And I don't think many greens. Is that it, Ken? Bananas, plantains. It's probably analyzed nutritionally. It's probably a serotonin-loaded diet because of the large amount of plantains in it. But it's a bland diet. It's just setting you up to be sensitive, I think, to the uptake of the alkaloids. That's an MAO inhibiting. Yes, ayahuasca works through inhibition of MAO. Good point. You see, normally DMT would be destroyed in the gut, but if you inhibit monoamine oxidase somehow, then it passes through the gut and is absorbed and passes into the blood. This was not known by Western pharmacology until the mid-1950s, but it's always been known in the Amazon. So the strategy, you see, what ayahuasca is really is a slow-release DMT trip where you take a plant that contains DMT and you combine it with an MAO inhibitor, and then when you take these together, the DMT slowly releases and you get the equivalent of a DMT flash but stretched out over about an hour and a half. And so you can watch it more carefully. And some people say, you know, that I overstress the visual side of things, that all kinds of things go on psychedelic drugs. Insights, conceptual breakthroughs, weird distortions of body image and this sort of thing. And this is all true, but to my mind, the visual thing is the most striking because it is so other. It is so highly organized, so demonstrably the product of intelligence. I mean, it's not a feeling, some weird feeling, you know, nausea or subthreshold poisoning or all of these things. These are feelings, but it's simply the release of understanding and visually processed understanding. Ken.
In addition to the other three possibilities, the souls of the dead and an extraterrestrial world, would you entertain the idea that what we're saying might be simply constructs from the subconscious?
Yes, well, that's the other possibility. Carl Jung had this wonderful phrase in talking about elves and fairies, and he said, autonomous psychic components escape from the ego's control and present themselves as independent beings. Well, that's just a description of a pretty twisted around state of mind. It's the idea, you know, that you see the self in the mirror, and then you bring the mirror down and shatter it, and suddenly there are hundreds of selves. Each fragment of the mirror reflects a self. This would be a conservative theory of what these things are, except that they don't look very much like the self. The shock in DMT is, if this is myself, then I don't know who I am. But yeah, one thing I've thought of in an effort to explain it is that they are fractally parts of the personality. That an elf is, you know, you put 10 elves together and you have a personality or something like that. And so these elves are literally autonomous psychic components that have broken free from the control of the ego. We say we've fallen to pieces, always talking about the psychedelic as a boundary dissolver. Well, maybe what happens when you smoke DMT is the boundary dissolves so quickly that you can say of the situation, that's me all over, because you're literally bouncing off the walls and visible to yourself. The illusion that you are stitched together within a body has been shattered. And your several or multiple personality components are jumping around the room. I think the most extreme case of that I ever saw was once I used to smoke, I don't recommend this, but in my vanished youth, I used to smoke DMT. And I smoked the DMT and it was wild. It went on for a long, long time and was very intense anyway. And suddenly, right in the middle of this trip, this woman came back from Easter vacation, came charging up onto the front porch of this house and threw open the front door and ran into my bedroom door and started beating on my door furiously. Well, being a double Scorpio and secretive anyway, I just was like had a heart attack. And I jumped off the bed right out of this DMT flash. I jumped out and I landed on my feet in the middle of this room, and something about moving so suddenly had like shattered the distinction between the two continua, and I carried it all into the room with me. And so the room was then filled with elves, and they were hanging off my arms and spinning me around, and there was this geometric object in the room that was spinning and clicking, and every time it would click, it would hurl a plastic chit across the room that had a letter in an alien language written on it. And these elves were screaming and bouncing off the walls. This machine was spinning in the air. These chits were ricocheting off the walls. And I was trying to deal with Rosemary in the middle of this. And, you know, it was a too muchness. It was a case of seeing too deeply into it. And you have, too many of those stacked up, and then you become reluctant. This is why I'm very cautious with it. The notion of having enough chutzpah or will or something to want to try and use this stuff, I can hardly imagine using it. I mean, every time I encounter it, my wish is to not be destroyed by it. And the idea of using it for anything just seems like blasphemy, you know. And probably is blasphemy. It's probably a good way to get cut down to size. Yeah.
Last night you were talking about how certain times harken back to other times.
Right.
To this formula. And in the beginning of this weekend, you were talking about the archaic revival. We're going towards or through. And I thought you were talking about going back to the time of that city in Turkey, you know, that 30,000 years.
Çatal Hüyük. Uh-huh.
Could you say a few words about that? I mean, is that connected?
Well, no, that's the basic notion, that somehow our future lies in our past.
Right.
And shamanism, well, the particular past that I wanted to concentrate on was this period of time after the melting of the last glacier 20,000 years ago, and for the 10,000 years following that, when there were pastoral populations in Africa and leaving Africa that had developed this ecological balance and this shamanic doorway to nature. See, at every... the computer isn't here, but at every glaciation, human populations were bottled up in Africa during the time when the ice pack was thick. Nobody was getting out. But only the last time were the people, was pastoralism developed in the intervening period. So it was 20,000 years ago, those people leaving Africa were herders of domesticated cattle, and all previous radiations out of Africa had been hunter-gatherers. Yeah, the Minoan civilization, see, Çatal Hüyük ended in 6500 BC, but what's interesting is this is when you get the earliest Minoan settlements, and they carry the pottery motifs and building styles of central Anatolia to Crete. So it appears that what happened was Çatal Hüyük was like the last outpost of this goddess culture, and when these wheel chariot Indo-European folks came down, the survivors of that actually went to Crete, and Crete became this weird institutionalized backwater where literally for three millennia the fossilized social forms of the previous matrilineal society were kept intact, while on Asia Minor, on the mainland, it all became about kingship, male lines of descent, and all that. It wasn't actually until that turning point at the top of the wave in 980 BC that the last vestiges of this goddess culture were crushed in Crete. And even then, you see the strain of mystical, of deep psychedelic mysticism that enters Greek religion is all imported from Crete. The northern Thracian strain in Greek religion is rational and airy and oriented toward physical space. But out of Crete came, you know, rites 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years old. And it was always said, even up until classical times, that the rites that were celebrated in secret at Eleusis were celebrated openly at Heracleion and Gnosis. So that's the connection. My fantasy about all this is, you see, Çatalhöyük represents such an advanced civilization over anything else existing that, and it can be traced back 1,000 years to Jericho. The people who built Jericho built a round tower there that was the absolute glory of the engineering world of 8,000 BC. And it was a grain storage tower. But then these Jericho people, it's hard to trace where they came from. What I think happened is that when you look at the stratigraphy of the Nile Valley, you discover that actually there weren't people in the Nile Valley much before 10,500 BC. Then suddenly these people appear who are called Natufian, and they build under the overhanging lips of cliffs and have a certain style of fetal burial in a honey pot and certain other characteristics, Natufians, and they appear out of nowhere. Well, anybody who studied them has wanted to connect them to the culture of old Europe that Maria Gimbutas talks about, simply based on the fact that they were so culturally advanced that the bias of all these scholars is to say, well, they must have come from the Balkans. But when you look at them as a cultural horizon, you see, to my mind, that they are unmistakably African. And that when you go to the Tassili Plateau in southern Algeria, you find the same style of building, of living under the lips of caves, and this same coarse-grained black pottery called Sudanese ware. The pottery, the animal motifs, the fixation on the vulture, the jackal, and the cow, these are all African animals that occur at Çatal, seems to suggest that there was actually a sweep of African civilization and out of Africa into the Middle East around 10,000 BC. These people built Jericho 1,000 years after that and settled southern Anatolia 1,000 years after that. Well, this is... What this suggests, then, is that you could go out to the Tassili Plateau with sufficient resources and conduct an archaeological survey, and the ultimate payoff in this fantasy is that you would unearth the archaeological equivalent of Eden. In other words, you would discover the Ur spot from which the Çatal civilization came, the site of this mushroom-using goddess cattle civilization. And when you read the accounts of the Tassili Plateau, there's every reason to think that this strategy would work. It's a windswept sandstone escarpment, and Henri Flot, who did the preliminary exploration out there, said that in these arroyos where the sand has been cleared away by the wind, there would be Neolithic stone chippings and detritus, sometimes up to 0.5 meter thick, indicating, you know, thousands and thousands of years of continuous habitation when this was all green. There is an enormous unexcavated tell out there that has never been dated, but it's just carried on the archaeological surveys as presumed pre-Islamic. It's enormous. So digging out there might be a very useful thing to do. It's from that area that we get these 9,000-year-old images of shamans with mushrooms sprouting out of their bodies, shamans carrying mushrooms over their heads and running in long chains with strange geometric motifs trailing along beside them. So it would be a kind of recovery. I think archaeology will play a big role in the archaic revival, that part of our cultural dilemma and our political infantilism comes from the fact that we don't know any history. So we're easily led, and we don't even really understand the history of the 20th century. I mean, you know, you ask somebody who Joseph Goebbels was, and they think he served in the Nixon cabinet. I mean, and so hardly to speak of who was Suleiman the Magnificent and just exactly what was Frederick Barbarossa's role in European history and so forth and so on. But recovering this is like waking up, gaining control. And, you know, I said yesterday, it's only been 1,500 generations of people that have walked us into this dilemma. But The archaic revival is a huge paradigm shift. You can imagine, remember the example I gave about the shift from the Renaissance, from the medieval to the Renaissance, which really was a giving up of the universal power of the church, the philosophical certitude of giving your allegiance to the Holy Father in Rome.